Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Migration Policy Institute for this briefing, Syria on the Edge, the Status of Refugees in Neighboring Countries. My name is Kathleen Newland, and I direct the Refugee Protection Program at MPI. We are live streaming this event today, and I'm pleased to welcome our online participants as well as those of you who are in the room with us today. I'd like to thank our co-sponsors for this event, Washington's Middle East Institute's Center for Turkish Studies, and particularly Dr. Gurnul Tol. Gurnul, please wave. She was really the prime instigator for this briefing, and I'm really very grateful. And our other co-sponsor, Ankara's Center for Middle Eastern Strategic Studies, ORSAM. We're delighted to have Dr. Saban Kardas, the president of ORSAM, with us today. The underpinning for this briefing is a new report from ORSAM entitled The Situation of Syrian Refugees in Neighboring Countries, Findings, Conclusions, and Recommendations. There is a link to the report on the webpage for this event on migrationpolicy.org, and I commend it to you very strongly. It is a report full of very detailed information of the sort that it is difficult to obtain apart from colleagues who have been long established in the region. As I'm sure you are aware, Washington's policy community is paying close attention to the crisis in Syria. 3 million displaced, over 160,000 dead. There have been many roundtables, briefings, panels, etc. But it's relatively rare that we have reports from researchers and policymakers from the countries in the region who have really been able to immerse themselves over a period of time in the situation. The ORSAM report is based on 6 months of field research in Turkey, Iraq, Jordan, and Lebanon. And as a result, it has a great sort of texture and detail that I have found certainly extremely valuable, and I'm sure you will too. We have a distinguished panel of speakers to introduce and comment in the report. Their biographies were on your chairs as you arrived, so I will not spend much time introducing them. Time is always too short for these events, so that's one efficiency we like to introduce. We're very privileged to have as our first speaker, live from Ankara, Dr. Fuat Aktay, the Director General of AFAD, which is the Disaster and Emergency Presidency, reporting directly to the Prime Minister of Turkey. We are especially grateful to him for joining us today, knowing how preoccupied he and his colleagues are with the mining disaster that has just taken place in Turkey. And I would like to offer our condolences to the families and communities of the miners who lost their lives, and to all of you who are working so hard to respond to the situation. So if I may ask you, Dr. Aktay, we're awaiting your comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen and Dr. Kardas. It's very great to be with such a wonderful audience indeed over there and wonderful friends out there. I wish I had been there to be with you, but as you have just mentioned, just due to a disaster, a mining disaster, I had to be at the field indeed. Just returned back from the field and basically joining you through the teleconferencing. I'll just try to make it as brief as possible indeed regarding the Syrian issue. It's been almost 4 years, indeed, that we have been dealing with the issue, not just as a country, but as a neighbor, indeed. We have been eyewitnessing, indeed, that's what has been going on out there, just sufferings of all those people. And with a country which has a very long border, it's almost impossible for Turkey to ignore what's been going on in Syria, indeed. So we have been trying our best, and we will be trying our best to make the situation, just to ease the situation and ease the suffering for those Syrians as much as possible, indeed. I'd like to thank to you and to Orsam, indeed, for getting involved such a great, huge issue and becoming part of it, especially to make the entire world hear about the issue, indeed. Thanks for raising the awareness. So what's the case right now in Turkey is that we have more than almost 1 million Syrians, indeed. It's been increasing day by day. I don't remember how many Syrians we had, Dr. Kardash, when we had the meeting at your office last time, but right now it's more than 1 million, and I'm afraid it's getting more and more, especially with the UN estimation. UN basically estimates that it's going to get the situation in Syria is going to get maybe worse, hopefully not. And the number of refugees in the neighboring countries, not only in Turkey but in the entire neighboring countries, are going to get higher and higher. So right now, indeed, since the beginning of the crisis, I just checked the dates. Indeed, it's April 11, 2011, indeed, that we had the first refugees entering Turkey with around 250 people. Since then, it's like within the 3 years have been over. It's already over, and we are in the fourth year right now. It's more than 1 million. So we have started basically building camps. We just indeed don't call them camps in Turkey. We call them temporary protection centers. Indeed, this is even not the name we call them cities, indeed, either tent cities or container cities, just to make them feel more comfortable that they live in a city rather than a camp, because it's not easy to live in a tent or container for 3 or 4 years, indeed. So we try our best to make them more comfortable, indeed. So we do have, as Turkey, as an open door policy from the first day, and we wish that our friends, especially in the Western countries, are going to follow this policy, indeed, the open border policy over there. The numbers, as the figures have increased, the number of the camps have increased as well, indeed. Right now, we do have around 22 camps. Let me just call it camp right now, just for the sake of understanding each other better. We do have 22 camps, especially in the near border cities, in 10 cities, indeed. And we have almost like more than 220,000 Syrians in those camps. The situation in those camps are comparatively, basically comparing to the others in the entire world, including the UN camps, it's relatively a lot better than anywhere in the world, indeed. As I said, it's just a city rather than a camp, indeed. It has its own educational campuses. It has its own, basically, healthcare campuses, logistics campuses. And even it has its own, regarding a special management model, indeed, in which the representatives of the people of the Syrians who live in those camps are represented in the camps. So they do select, they do elect, basically, their reps from each community, and those reps are basically represent their own community in the camp management. So through those camps, indeed, we are not just offering shelter or food. Indeed, we are offering a lifestyle to those who live there. We are basically trying to get them a taste of having a saying in their own lives, basically a kind of taste of democracy in a way, if you would like to put it into that way. As far as the number of students, like out of those 1 million, almost 50% are kids, and 30% are students, which makes it 500,000 kids are in Turkey, living in Turkey, and almost like 300,000 students living in Turkey indeed. So this is all indeed, from another point of view, it's a kind of like needs analysis maybe. Out of those 300,000 kids just in the camps, we have around 70,000 students. We have schools in every single camp, and basically through UNICEF also. UNICEF is somehow involved, but mainly the Turkish government. UNHCR is also involved in those camps in terms of observing and monitoring what has been going on in those camps. Just indeed, the most recent figures that I checked, the number of people who have given shelters in those camps have basically is around 500,000. So nearly 270,000 of them have gone back somehow or under the supervision of UNHCR. However, the numbers are skyrocketing in Turkey indeed. Out of those nearly 70,000 kids, students in the camps, around 7,500 are preschool, around again 34,000 is primary school students, nearly 19,000 are secondary school, and 9,000 are high school students. And some of our kids have graduated those schools and have started universities, colleges indeed, in Turkey as well. So we do have more than 3,000 teachers educating those kids over there, mostly the Arabic teachers. That's one of the barriers indeed for us, because the language, there's a language barrier in Turkey. It's Turkish over there, so that's why we have to somehow set up a different setting for those kids indeed, for to be able to teach them in Arabic. We do have also training services for the kind of like vocational services for the adults as well. So we do have more than 30,000 people who have already graduated from those classes, which include language schools, including English, Turkish, Arabic, and computer classes, hairdressing, and all those types of courses indeed. We have around 300 of those courses in those camps. As far as the healthcare is concerned, right so far we have 2.8 million. We have provided 2.8 million healthcare services. Additionally, we have provided another more than 400,000 healthcare services through the hospitals. The previous one was through the clinics, indeed. And then, of course, we do have nearly 50,000 operations. The good part is, indeed, the newborns. We have around 12,000. The exact number as of today is 12,366. Those are the newborns in our camps, indeed. Everything is kind of is under control in those camps, no problem. The conditions are good, again, no problem. The people in those camps might be luckier comparing to the conditions in other parts of the world for Syrians, indeed, especially in their own home in Syria. However, the conditions for those non-camp refugees are not. I'm just, I would like to repeat on that part, are not as lucky as the ones in the camps. Yes, we are trying our best to provide all kinds of support to those people as well. We have granted the healthcare services to almost every single person, every single Syrian who have entered to Turkey free of charge, even more rights than Turkish citizens in. However, healthcare services is not just enough for individuals or for those Syrians indeed to live. We have started, especially the second part we have started concentrating is the educational services. We are trying to kind of like get those kids out of the streets. We know that we have to be taking them out of the streets. So, but as again Turkish government, we are trying our best, but at this point, we have raised our voice through different channels indeed, through our through UN, through EU organizations, through our Minister of Foreign Affairs, through UNICEF, through UNHCR, but so far it has not helped much indeed. Many people have visited Turkey, including the UN General Secretary and UN ex-General Secretary Kofi Annan, basically Mr. Guterres. He has been over here, and he has been eyewitnessing indeed the conditions in Turkey, and he's one of the individuals who know the best in terms of what kind of services Turkey is providing, offering to their Syrian guests indeed. Valerie Amos, UN Deputy General Secretary, is also very, she also is very well aware of the services we have been providing. But the amount of services that is needed and the amount of help that has been offered is not even comparable. There is a huge gap in between. Yes, the UN local office, Turkey's office, is trying their best, but they are in a way they are helpless, because they are not getting the help and they are not able to get the attention that they deserve from the world and even from the UN headquarters indeed. UNICEF is trying its best, but with 10 or 15 schools for 300,000 kids, nobody is going to be able to solve that problem. So rather than providing just for the sake of providing offer, I think we have to, especially international organizations and especially our Western allies, have to take more serious effort indeed in becoming part of the kind of like relief efforts that has been going on in Turkey. Of course, there is more than that. There are people, almost like 700,000 people, more than 700,000 people that we have been talking about. There are people who have come to Turkey, but unfortunately no granted income coming from their Syrian side, or they don't have an income, a regular income. Even the wealthy Syrians who have come to Turkey through legal ways and were able to support themselves are not able to support themselves anymore. So there is a great issue out there as well indeed. Basically, I don't want to keep it long. I would like to keep it short, provide my messages as clear as possible, and answer questions if you have any. I don't know the format of the meeting, if the format allows, of course. Basically, as I have said in summary, just let me give you one more, let me share a couple of figures with you indeed. The international health, it's around $220 million so far. The cost, the Turkey so far, based upon the UN standards, we have spent more than $3 billion. So $220 million is in addition to that amount. $141 million out of this $222 belongs to UN institutions indeed. WFP is one of our partners in the camps, of course. UNHCR, UNICEF is some of those institutions, organizations indeed. Saudi Arabia has one major contribution with $50 million. The rest is almost none. Just I have UNHCR's figures indeed over here. This is a kind of like, I think I'd like to just share that figure indeed. UNHCR report states that we do have more than 1 million in Turkey, but based upon the UNHCR report, the Western, our Western allies have pledged to accept 18,000 of Syrians. So 18,000 comparing to 1 million, I guess I don't need to compare the two, I guess.
Yes.
Just as far as the stats concerned, do I have time?
If you're definitely willing to entertain a few questions, that would be wonderful. So please give us the information you were about to give us, and then we'll have just a few questions, if you would.
Okay. Should I stop or?
If you're ready to conclude, we will open the floor.
Okay. Let me just conclude. So I'll just then skip some of those statistics that I have and basically just state that Turkey has been involved not only in the Syrian issue but throughout the entire world indeed, based upon, again, the UN report, basically right now it's open to public, explained in Geneva. Turkey ranks the fourth and ranks third as a country after United States, following United States and the United Kingdom. Turkey is trying its best. We have been trying our best, not only again in Syria, but almost like throughout the entire world, from Philippines to Afghanistan to Haiti, Chile, Somalia, Syria, wherever there is a problem, we are going to be there just for the humanitarian reasons. Again, thanks. Let me conclude here and basically open the floor for the questions.
Our thanks to you, really, for giving us that picture of Turkey's extraordinary efforts with Syrian refugees, and as you mentioned at the end, beyond that, in with other humanitarian needs. So Dr. Aktay has agreed to ask a few questions. We have a mic circulating in the room. And if you would be kind enough, please, to introduce yourself and to keep your question brief, we would appreciate it.
Thank you. It's İlhan Tanır from Turkish Press. I have a very quick question for the chief of AFAD. You talk about 18,000 Syrians to Europe, but you haven't talked about the U.S. As far as I know, please correct me if I am wrong, I think there are less than 2,000 Syrians so far granted amnesty in U.S. Can you tell us how it is possible that countries such as U.S. is accepting or inviting so few Syrians? Thank you.
I guess, thank you indeed. I guess it might be one of the questions out there. It might be the awareness issue. I don't know. It might be a political issue. I'm not sure, but let me just give you a couple of numbers. In the U.S. is around 2,000, Norway 1,000, England, France and Australia 500, Denmark 140, Belgium 130, Hungary 10, and Liechtenstein 4. So these are the numbers. I guess that platform is a better place to discuss maybe the reasons why our Western allies are somehow either less concerned or somehow they don't have as much awareness as, or they don't have as much sensitivity as we do. I don't think it's just a neighborhood issue. I strongly believe that there is more into that. So that platform is going to be a better platform to discuss the details, I guess.
Yes, thank you for that. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe those 18,000 resettlement places don't include Syrians who have gotten asylum in other countries, although those numbers are also very, very few compared to the burden that is being borne by...
Indeed, there were days and nights that we were getting more than 10,000 refugees over a night, and we were able to somehow accept them and basically either put them into camps or provide other shelters indeed to them. More than 10,000 people overnight. So this is a huge operation indeed.
It is extraordinary.
But this is indeed maybe, just to make it short again, we do need an international burden sharing over here. So we don't have that international border burden sharing. We do need, again, as I remember just talking about the open border policy, not only for Turkey, but also for all the countries, repatriation, and continuous and sustainable aid system. Indeed, Turkey is also providing help to the Syrian side as well. So what we have is that this is a kind of like new system within the UN new method within the UN system, indeed. We call it zero border point aid system. What we do is, this is totally, this totally abides to the international law. Basically, we do accept all the aid through Red Crescent, and then whoever needs aid from the other side of the border, from the Syrian side, they can come and get that help aid from there. So we have spent more than $200 million over there, and also through our NGOs, there is another $400 to $500 million spent in those areas as well, in addition to $3 billion that we have spent as government.
Thank you. I see one additional. I'm afraid we'll only have time for one more question. And would you kindly introduce yourself?
My name is President of the Syrian American Medical Society. We're doing a lot of medical relief through Turkey, and we're one of the NGOs that is collaborating with the Turkish Red Crescent for medical relief. We really appreciate what the Turkish people and the Turkish government have been doing to the Syrian refugees and people, and I cannot express my feeling toward what Turkey has done towards my brothers and sisters from Syria. And no matter what we say, we cannot give appreciation to what you have done. And I hope that you understand that the Syrian American community in general is one of your best friends here in the United States. We are gearing for our international conference in Turkey next month. This is our second international conference, and we hope that we can meet with you. But my question, of course, I want to convey also my condolences for what happened in the mine disaster recently. If anything we can do, we'll be happy to. My question is, the Syrian American diaspora, what do you think they can contribute to what the Turkish government and people have been doing towards Syria? We've been providing some medical relief, but I don't think that there's much need in Turkey compared to Lebanon or Jordan. What else we can do?
Indeed, and this is a very good question indeed. Thanks for your condolences. We do have a system for those non-camp refugees as well, indeed. What we have been trying is that we have basically transformed or translated the lessons learned in the camps. It's one of the best practices. Indeed, what we did is has taken those best practices and from the model. In that model, what we have is, it's a pool. We have been registering all the Syrians. We have registered almost like more, nearly 550,000 of those. Once we registered them all, but right now the system works as of today. This is an IT, this has an IT system in itself as well. Once we register, what we have over there is the needs analysis, a clear needs analysis. How many kids, where, at which grade, and their needs. So this is gonna, this basically provides the schooling needs for the kids. And also, we, when we register them, we do gather their health. We do ask questions regarding their health, basically. We do have that information, so that also provides the amount of healthcare services needed and also the type of healthcare services that's needed and also where. We do have economic situation of those Syrians as well in that system. That also provides the need, the economic need that they will they will need indeed. So at one side of this system, what we call this, it's an AFAD aid distribution system. In one side, we do have the demand. We have registered them all, and we have been continuing to register. And at the other side, what we have done is we have basically asked to UN, EU, and the entire world and the NGOs to register to that system as well. So we are able to provide user ID and password for that system so that you can see online needs for 724. So then you might donate, you might commit for certain donations in terms of once you see those needs, you can basically tell in which area you would like to donate. And this is going to be through classical ways. You will be basically distributing your own donations, basically whatever the contribution that you are making, you will be meeting with the refugees and providing your support to them. However, through this system, what we are doing is we are making sure that one family does not get five times or ten times of help from different NGOs while another one does not get any. So you will be able to report it back to your donors indeed. So this is a working system right now available. So what we would like to offer you and to the entire world indeed, to register into that system, become part of it, and see the needs and basically become the part of the system. We do have the projects indeed, schooling projects, hospital projects, and other kind of projects as well indeed. So as AFAD, we can provide those projects to you, and basically we can provide the financial need for over there. If you want, you can go ahead and basically construct or perform whatever the things that needs to be done over there. Or if you want, we can do it for you. We know what is needed in Turkey. We know how much is needed for the Syrians in Turkey. And we know where it is needed in Turkey. If you would like to become part of it, you are most welcome. Please just give us a call. It's just that easy.
Well, thank you very, very much, Dr. Oktay, for taking time to join us here today. We're really grateful and wish you all the best in your work and hope that the needed assistance arrives quickly. And above all, that the war in Syria comes to a conclusion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please accept my regards and have a wonderful and successful conference over there, workshop.
Thank you.
Have a nice day.
Thank you. I would like to turn now to Dr. Saban Kardash, the president of ORSAM, to introduce the report on the situation of Syrian refugees. He will be followed by Oytun Orhan, a researcher at ORSAM, who acted as project manager for this report and the research that went into it. And then to comment on the report contents, we will have Perihan Akrawi-Whitcomb from the Middle East Research Institute, who will discuss specifically the situation of Syrian refugees in the Kurdish region of Iraq, where she has worked for some time.
Just arrived yesterday.
Just arrived back yesterday from there. So this will be a very immediate perspective. And then we will have... Dr. Faisal Itani from the Atlantic Council, who is going to respond about the situation in Lebanon. So, Dr. Kardash, if you will, be so kind.
Thank you, Kathleen. And also I would like to thank Gönül for putting us together at this excellent organizational event. I'm not going to take much time because Oytun will be talking about the main conclusions of the report, especially given that we are running out of time a little bit in terms of the introduction by Dr. Oktay. I will give briefly some background to our project, then hand over to Oytun. I mean, we were driven by the belief that the Syrian crisis was a crisis that needed to be handled by the international community at large, not only the regional actors. And then it had a very serious and increasingly grave humanitarian situation, so we wanted to cover that at ORSAM. And that with that consideration, we wanted to look at especially the spillover effects of the Syrian crisis. And most people in the West, they do talk about the dramatic security situation, the civil war, but the Syrian crisis is not just burning inside. It is not just affecting the Syrian people. The crisis is affecting the neighbors as well through different interconnections between Syria and its neighbors. So in that sense, the movement of people across borders, which we see in almost any humanitarian tragedy, has been the case here. So we see that the neighbors have been affected through the movement of refugees. But it's not just the Syrian refugees that go to different countries who suffer, who are affected, but also the host communities are affected by this population movements, especially considering that in many of the neighboring countries of Syria, the tensions that led to the political crisis are also existing. So we were also wondering to what extent those tensions in terms of ethnic or sectarian or religious or political conflicts have been aggravated by the movement of people, to what extent the host societies have been affected economically, politically, and socially. So with that consideration in mind, we decided to study the conditions of the Syrian refugees, but also their impact on the local societies, local economies. So we did carry out field work in Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq, and of course, Turkey. Our research was generously supported by the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung, the German foundation, which I should also mention and again thank here. And then we recently launched the report. We had a workshop in Ankara as well with the participation of researchers from Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq. Today we were hoping to have a colleague from Jordan as well, who also carried out a study in his own country, but unfortunately because of visa issues he couldn't make it. At least today we have speakers who are going to look at the issue from a Lebanese point of view, from an Iraqi, northern Iraqi point of view. And then, as I said, this is a crisis. The Syrian crisis is a crisis that has created a lot of spillover effects, and the humanitarian side of the story, the refugees, is only one of them. And personally, and also at ORSAM in our research, we realized that the crisis has also been to some extent mismanaged by the international community. Here we see the failures of the international community in terms of addressing the needs of the refugees. But the local countries that did receive the refugees, they have different capacities. They have different political frictions. So the impact has been uneven. In each case, you see different patterns. But despite that, we also see similarities in the impact. In some countries, you see similar trends. In other countries, the impact also differs. But also the assistance of the international community differs from case to case. So in the report, you find most of these conclusions. We can also discuss them here. Before I hand over to Oytun, I just would like to note that also a copy of the interview we conducted with Dr. Oktay is available just next to the report. If you are interested in his views, the Turkish take, there's some more in it, I would say. Thank you.
Excellent. And again, thank you so much for coming. So please, Oytun, we'll go straight to you.
Thank you very much, Kathleen. In my presentation, I will not focus on the situation of the Syrian refugees in countries because my colleagues will focus on that issue. Berihan and Faisal will focus on the situation of the Syrian refugees in Iraq and Lebanon. But I will try to present the findings of our project, of our report in my limited time. Let me start with some giving some basic data about the Syrian refugees. You can see the numbers of the Syrian refugees who immigrated to the neighboring countries. You can, in total, you can see that there are nearly 3 million Syrian refugees who immigrated to the neighboring countries. Actually, you have to take into consideration that these numbers only include the numbers that registered Syrian refugees. So there are more than Syrian refugees who are settled in those host neighboring countries. For example, in Turkey, as Mr. Oktay said that, although I wrote 600,000, there are nearly 1 million Syrian refugees in Turkey. And in Jordan, there are 480,000 Syrian refugees, but this is the only registered Syrian refugees. But the numbers, when we were in Jordan, when we talked with the Jordanian officials, they give us the number that there are between 1.2 and 1.5 million Syrian refugees in Jordan. And it is also the case in Lebanon and in Iraq. The ones living in Lebanon in the camps is 200,000, but there are nearly 800,000 Syrians in Lebanon, and if we include the ones who are not registered, it is 1.2 and between 1.2 and 1.5 Syrians living in Lebanon. If we look at this table, this table shows us the refugees' place of origin and the cities that refugees are settled in the host country. This table actually shows us, tells us two things. First of all, the main factor that the refugees decides where to go is that there is geography. Geography is very important when they are deciding where to go. Because when you look at the cities that refugees are settled in the host country, is, for example, in Jordan, it is Irbit, Mafraq, Amman, and Zarqa. Irbit, Mafraq, and Zarqa are the governorates which are in the border region. And also, this is the same situation for all other countries. So, geography is very important when the immigrants are deciding where to go. And the second thing that this table shows is that there is a direct correlation between the identity of the refugees and where they decide to go. The majority, vast majority of the Syrians are Sunni Arabs. And when you look at the places they are, that they are, they choose to immigrate, is, for example, in Lebanon, is Akkar, is Tripoli, and Zahle. And those regions are mainly Sunni Arab populated regions. So this identity issue, being a member of a specific ethnic and sectarian identity, is very crucial when they are deciding where to go. Because Akkar, Tripoli, and Zahle are mainly Sunni populated regions in Lebanon. And it's also the Iraqi case is a very clear example of this situation, because the immigration from Syria to Iraq is mainly the Syrian Kurdish migration to Iraq, to Iraqi Kurdistan. So the people who are migrating from Iraq to Syria are mainly Kurdish originated people to Iraqi Kurdistan. So geography is very important in that respect, and also your identity is very important when you are deciding where to go. And in my presentation, I will try to focus on the findings of the reports. My colleagues will focus on the situation on the countries. I will try to put the situation in the neighboring countries in a comparative manner with respect to the situation of the camps, the local refugee relations, and also the radicalization trends among Syrians, and also local people and Syrian relations. And in that respect, if we start with the situation of the camps, we can say that, as Mr. Oktay said, that Turkey is in a foremost position regarding the camp conditions among the countries. We visited the four countries. We had chance to visit the whole camps in all neighboring countries. And I can say that the camp conditions in Turkey is in a foremost position regarding the camp conditions, regarding the hygienic, the order, the social activities, the accommodation conditions. In all respects, the Turkish camps are in a foremost position. In Lebanon, there are no official camps. Because of political reasons, Lebanon do not accept to establish camps. But besides, the civil society organizations, with the help of international donors, they establish small scale of camps, but the conditions are not so good. In Jordan, the majority, nearly the whole of them, are staying in Zaatari camp. Nearly 110,000 people are staying in Zaatari camp. 95% are staying in that camp. So the conditions are not so good. When we compare, we can say that the conditions in the Zaatari camp is the worst in all four countries. With regards to new refugee waves, we can say that Lebanon and Jordan is under high risk. Because when the refugees are deciding to immigrate and where to immigrate, it is the security factor that leads them to decide to immigrate. And when the new refugee waves in that context, if the situation in the Damascus, like in Aleppo case, the battles in Damascus intensifies, this will trigger a huge amount of migration to the Lebanon and Jordan. So I can say that Jordan and Lebanon is under high risk of accepting new refugee waves. Turkey is standing in the middle because the situation in the northern part of Syria, which is close to Syria, seems to be much more settled. So, and also the settlements in the northern Syria are already evacuated. So the Turkey is under middle risk, but the situation in Iraq is under low risk because the Kurdish regions in Iraq seem to be much more secure, so the possibility of new refugee waves to Iraqi Kurdistan seems to be a low possibility. When we look at the local refugee relations, we can say that there is anger toward refugees in all four countries. However, none of them has the risk of an all-out social conflict. Syrians' major concern is safety. They feel safer near their relatives and near people with similar ethnic and sectarian origins. The Syrians living in the south of the country migrated to the north and of Jordan, and where they may have kinship relationship with the people living there. So most of the Syrians who migrated to Lebanon are Sunni. They settled in the north of Lebanon, where the Sunni population lives. The migration towards Iraq is almost wholly the immigration of the Syrian Kurds to the territories controlled by the KRG. Sunni Arabs, Kurds, Turkmens, and Christians migrated to Turkey. For Turkmens and Kurds, both sides of the border are connected with kinship relationship, and Mardin is the old settlement of the Syrian Christians. Therefore, notwithstanding the exceptions, the migration of settlement of the Syrian Christians, therefore migration, then identity values determined the relations between the local people and Syrian refugees. In all four countries, local people initially felt sympathy for refugees. However, they started to feel resentment towards refugees over time. In Lebanon, the Sunni people are disquiet for the reason that they are exposed to the social and economic impact of the refugee flows. Similarly, the Kurdish people in Iraq started to complain about refugees, which they initially felt sympathy and affinity. This is similar in Turkey and Jordan as well. The popular reaction in Jordan is mostly in the northern provinces. The popular resentment is limited to a few border provinces in Turkey, since Turkey is geographically larger and its economically is not directly affected. And when we come to the situation of the Syrians living outside the camps, the refugees living outside the camps are trying to survive in tough conditions. These Syrians cause problems about social integration in all four countries. Refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq speak the same language as the local people. So this is an advantage for social integration. But when we look at the Turkey case, Turkish people do not share the common culture or do not speak the same language. So this might be seen as a disadvantage for social integration. But the advantage for the Turkey is that Turkey is a, with regards to geography and its economy, it is more easy for Turkey to absorb the Syrian immigrants in Turkey. So, for example, when we look at the Gaziantep case, there are more than 100,000 Syrians living in Gaziantep, but the population of the Gaziantep is more than 2 million. So the Syrians in Gaziantep are not so visible. But when we look at the Lebanon case, the total population of the Lebanon is 4 million and they are hosting 1 million people. So they are so much visible. And the economy of the Lebanon is not enough to absorb that much Syrians in their country. So this is an advantage of the Turkey. When we look at the ethnic sectarian polarization, I can say that Lebanon is under high risk. This is because of their political and social structure, which is based on quotas distributed to different sects and ethnic in Lebanon. So Lebanon is also already polarized in sectarian lines. So, and also Lebanon has become a direct partner of the Syrian civil war. So this also increases the level of ethnic sectarian polarization in Lebanon. But I can say that in Iraq and in Jordan, there is low possibility for ethnic sectarian polarization. In Turkey, it is limited with the bordering cities, mainly in Hatay, as it has close ties with the Syria and has a heterogeneous demographic structure. And the desire to migrate to third countries, we can say that with regards to our findings, Turkey is the more likeliest country to, the Syrians are more likely to migrate to third countries because of geography. Turkey is traditionally and historically is a country that is a transit route for the migrants from east to west. So this is also the case for the Syrians. Now, at the beginning, there were a lot of Syrians living in the border area, but now we have a lot of Syrians living in Ankara, in Istanbul. So these people, these Syrians, these immigrants will probably to go to European countries. So the Turkey is the most probable country which the Syrians will try to go to third countries. And regarding the radicalization trends, I can say that Jordan is under high risk because the conditions are very bad in Jordan. And the Syrians in Lebanon are living, also in Lebanon are living under harsh conditions. So in Lebanon and Jordan, there is a high risk of radicalization among Syrians. The Lebanese support, either the regime or the opposition, there is a direct polarization among the Syrian Lebanese society. So this affects the position of the Syrian immigrants inside Lebanon. So we can say that also we can add that the there is a the conditions of the immigrants inside Lebanon is very hard and taken. Those conditions, we can say that there is a high possibility of radicalization of Syrians inside Lebanon and in Syria. I think I'm out of time. Actually, I have some evaluations about some about the countries specifically, but I have to conclude here. Maybe we can conclude in the Q&A session. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm very much. The report is really so full of content that I thank you for getting through as much of it as you were able to in this short time. And I'm sure we will come back to some of these questions in the Q&A. So let me now turn to Perihan to tell us about her observations in the Kurdistan region.
First of all, thank you very much to the organizers for having me. I just arrived, as I said, yesterday from Erbil, and I'm going to return tonight. And I just want to make clear, when I return, I'm going to work for the Middle East Research Institute, which is going to be the first independent think tank that's based in Erbil. I was volunteering for the last year in the Kurdistan region, basically with the Syrian refugee crisis. And yeah, and I also want to congratulate Orsam on this report. I find it's really filling a gap. So I'm going to basically start talking during the presentation. You're going to see why I'm focusing on the Kurdistan region when we talk about the refugee crisis in Iraq. The Kurdistan region, first of all, what is it? It's the autonomous federal region of Iraq. It has a population of 5.2 million. All of Iraq has around 32 million. It consists of three governorates, Erbil, Sulaymaniyah, and Duhok, and hosts 97% of the Syrian refugees in Iraq. It's an area larger than the Netherlands and four times the area of Lebanon. The official language in the Kurdistan region is Kurdish and Arabic. And as stipulated in Iraq's federal constitution, Kurdistan's institution exercise legislative and executive authority in many areas, including regional budget, policing, security. It borders Iran to the east, Turkey to the north, and Syria to the west. The Kurdistan region itself just only shares 20 kilometers border with Syria, compared to all of Iraq, around 600 kilometers. It is landlocked, but has two international airports, soon going to have a third one. And it's witnessing an economic boom, drawing back many exiled Kurds who had fled oppression and persecution by the former Ba'ath regime. It has provided open border policies in regards to the Syrian refugees, unlike the central government of Iraq. It has a workforce of 1.2 million and an unemployment rate of 6%. The Kurdistan region itself has some experience with refugees and internally displaced people, as it is already hosting 250,000 Iraqi IDPs, internally displaced IDPs, who have fled sectarian violence and terrorism in the last decade, hosts 26,000 Iraqi Christian families from Baghdad and Mosul area, then these around 250,000 Syrian refugees, which, like Oytin said, are mainly from Kurdish origin, and recently 30,000 Arab internally displaced refugees from the Anbar governorate. That makes over 500,000 refugees. And while Iraq is still suffering from daily attacks and instability, this drives more into the Kurdistan region in the north. The status of the Syrian refugees, as you can see, this is a map. These red tent-like shaped symbols are the refugee camps, all in all there. And then you can see on this smaller map the concentration of the camps. So, like Oytin also indicated, the closer the proximity to the Syrian border, the higher the concentration of the refugees. So most of the refugees are in the Duhok governorate and mainly in the Dumis camp. These are all data from the UNHCR report. That it's like a monthly brief, and you can find it online. It's the April version, so these data are from end of April. And again, here you can see from left to right is like the three governorates, Duhok, Erbil, and Sulaymani. And Duhok being the government closest to the border of Syria, having the largest concentration of refugees. By 2013, out of those 250,000 Syrian refugees in Iraq, nearly 120,000 of them lived in cities like Duhok and Erbil, while the other remained and lived in tent camps. And then you can see, for example, in the Erbil government, we have a percentage compared towards the host community, it's like 5% of the host community. Duhok government, it's a share of 9%. And now to the trend. Unfortunately, the Syrian crisis is unfortunately expected to continue, and Syrian refugees will keep on arriving. The crisis will continue, as I said, unfortunately, and those who have fled because of war will still continue to come in the future, even if tomorrow the Syrian war would end. It will be the economy is broken, so the region is preparing for itself for more people to come and to have a long-term strategy. And according to the UNHCR prediction, by the end of 2014, they predict that the refugees in Iraq are going to double to up to 400,000. the role of the Kurdistan Regional Government. The Kurdistan Regional Government has open border policy towards the refugees. It has established refugee camps with the assistance of the UNHCR. It administers the camps in partnership with UN agencies, international and local NGOs. It grants residency and work permits to all Syrian refugees, so the camps refugees can leave the camps, but on a three-month basis. And because of the high numbers, the residency is systematically handed out, so, but they cannot absorb them. So they examine in one camp, they're issuing the permanent residency like up from 10 to 15 people per day. So, but basically everyone has the right to work. The Ministry of Natural Resources has a, basically they have a lot of initiatives, such as the Ministry of Natural Resources that has donated $10 million and has established a humanitarian initiative called KOGI, the Kurdistan Oil and Gas Humanitarian Initiative. And as maybe some of you know, Kurdistan is the Kurdistan region is seeing an oil and gas boom, and we have a lot of international oil and gas companies, and these have who are operating locally, and these have recently donated $15 million, which there's also a report online where you can see to which organizations they have and what projects they have been donating their money to. The UN and Human Rights Watch and various others have praised the commitment of the KRG to the refugees. There are still no official numbers on how much the refugee crisis has cost the KRG. The general perception in the KRG among the population is very compassionate still towards the refugees, because they themselves just 20 years ago have been fleeing, like 3 million Kurds from Iraq had been fleeing to the neighboring countries such as Turkey and Syria. So they're well aware of their plight. Iraq's central government has still been reluctant on assisting the KRG on the refugees. In fact, the KRG is, because of the unstable situation of central Iraq, still receiving many refugees from all over Iraq. I think time is not there, so I'm going to speak now. The refugee crisis has been detrimental to many of the developing economies, as we know, in the Middle East, and the critical humanitarian aid to refugees. These governments had to divert basically valuable resources that they need themselves because they're developing economies for the Syrian refugee crisis. This comes in terms of food and material aid, increased security concerns, decreasing local wages and government collections. And as a result of a sudden influx of labor, pricing shocks, and as a result of scarcity and desperation, increases in health and service demands and others. Furthermore, the economy of the Kurdistan region is arguably more fragile than that of its neighbors, as the region itself only recently is emerging from several decades of crisis and genocide by the former Baathist regime. The Kurdistan region hosts its own sizable internally displaced population, as I mentioned before, and the residents continue to rely on the public distribution system for food and household items. And indeed, all over Iraq as a whole maintains one of the largest public welfare systems in the world for its own residents. And with the refugee influx, this refugee influx heavily strains this critical system, which maybe the main population of Iraq is relying on. And to offset this strain, the international organization governments have provided financial support to countries in the MENA region. For example, the U.S. government supplied the government of Iraq and Baghdad with $45 million to offset the cost of hosting these refugees. But this money should have been distributed to the appropriate authorities, remembering that 97% are located in the Kurdistan region. But so far, just 7 million have arrived. And this we have this to put in the context that comes in the context there has been as in the past a dispute between the KRG and the central government about the budget. So yeah, the plight of the Syrian refugees, I'm just going to short. I mean, this 8 minutes is I think every country needs its own week. But coming to the plight of the Syrian refugees, the uncertainties. First of all, they have uncertainties of returning home. many camps resemble more and more permanent settlements. This is like, you can see that from Domi's camp in the Hook, especially because they can go out and work. They bring back, I mean, the money, it's not a lot, but they start to build their tents. A tent is becoming a house, and slowly they're extending, and who knows? I mean, it seems like that in 5 years it's going to be a settlement, Domi's, like the outskirts of the Hook. You see they have their own, like, little shops, barber shops, or they're, like, I'm going to show you some pictures where you can see. Yeah, jobs are often available in construction service industry, but the question is how long? And not to forget the psychological impact of war, forced migration, and sudden reality of severe socioeconomic poverty cannot be forgotten. The harsh winter conditions in camps and hot summer months are fertile ground for diseases despite UN and KRG efforts. While you can register no major food shortages within camps, but the price of inflation housing, inflation of housing and food outside the camps presents the biggest hardship for Syrian refugees, but also for the local population, as Oydin mentioned before. Here you can see these are the schools provided by the UNICEF, and here like a little shop owner. This is in the camp. A local hospital, and then several NGOs, for example. This is a twice a week a car that brings pregnant women into the town, into the city for checkups. And so it's basically the help of with the local population, NGOs, UNHCR and the KRG, that they're trying to do their best. But I think, yeah, while Turkey has maybe the best quality of camps, and like what's indicated in your report, that but they are suffering from boredom, or that you can see in Kurdistan, it's maybe they're trying the best that they can do, but at least they have, it's not, they can get out of their camps and they can start alive by trying, having a job. We have a lot in the camps, there's a rule, they have to be volunteers. The teachers are volunteers, refugees from the camp, the nurses from the camp. And I think, like I said before, it's not all loom and doom. There are the positive developments. The Syrian refugees have brought in their active force in the labor market. They have brought a lot of skilled labor people out. You can see it. A lot of businessmen have come over, and it has changed for the better. But yes, how to cope with them, will we integrate them? The best thing, I guess, is to help the Syrians in Syria to end this war and help them to get back to their homes. And I just remember when I started volunteering, it was this the deputy director of the Barzani Charity Foundation, it's an NGO, who's the main operator with the UNHCR and the camp. He was telling me, so it was my first time in a camp, and he looked at me and said, don't be sorry that we will provide for the food and we will provide for the long term for the basics, but it's about restoring the human dignity. Mm. And you can see it's really exceptional how these refugees have, how proud they are, and how they are very exceptional. And
thank you so much. And I really appreciate your making the point that there are some positive aspects to these flows, as well as the tremendous challenges which you and the other speakers have outlined. So we'll turn without further ado to Faisal. Peri Khan is quite right to say that each country could easily absorb an hour, but unfortunately we have only a few minutes. I would love to get a few questions in from the audience. So. Do your best.
My thanks to NPR and to all of you. I'm conscious of the fact that I'm the last speaker, so I will be brief. I'm not so much going to offer a survey of the situation, which Orsam has done such a good job of, but rather just give some analysis and put it in political context in Lebanon. The United Nations, as of yesterday, said that there will be approximately 1.5 million Syrian refugees in Lebanon by the end of the year. To put that in perspective, that's about a third of the country. Obviously, the direct impact of the humanitarian catastrophe, there are reasons unique to Lebanon that I think make it especially worrying. Most obviously, in my opinion at least, it's the country with the least capacity to absorb and accommodate these refugees, and also the one least likely to maintain its political stability and integrity in the process. Except for the capital, Beirut, and the areas north and east of it, Lebanon is essentially a state in name only. Its politics are deadlocked. The executive and legislative branches function minimally at best. Its infrastructure is poor. Its public services are as well. And security forces are overstretched and weak and politicized. And unfortunately, through a twist of bad luck, these weaknesses are especially apparent in those parts of Lebanon that have seen the highest refugee flows in the north and in the eastern parts of the Bekaa Valley. And so these are the sort of structural problems. But of course, there's the political context in Lebanon as well. This all is all happening against the backdrop of memories of the Lebanese Civil War, of which the sort of proximate trigger was the inflow and militarization of hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees in the 60s and 70s. The parallel is imperfect at best, obviously, but psychologically for many Lebanese, that led them to reject the idea of offering a sort of long-term infrastructure to settle the refugees, including in the form of camps. But I think not only in those forms, I think institutionally in general. And there seems to be sort of political consensus, which is rare in Lebanon, over this. And obviously there's also the sectarian element, my colleagues described in detail, the most pertinent fact being that these are overwhelmingly Sunni Muslim refugees. The Sunni Muslim population in Lebanon is approximately, give or take, a third. Don't quote me on those figures because they're very divisive. But the point of fact is that as non-Sunnis see it, the Sunni population of the country is just increased by 1 million to 1.5 million people, upsetting this kind of long-held sectarian balance and reinforcing mistrust between the sects at a time when Sunni-Shia relations have been poor for the past decade or so anyway. And so the most sort of dramatic example of this is some pretty influential politicians, not Sunnis, going so far as to call for a forced deportation of many of these refugees and their relocation across the border into Syria. Now, this obviously hasn't gained traction for a whole number of reasons, but it is not as general an opinion and school of thought as you'd think in Lebanon. So essentially, in addition to the burden on government, it's the burden on politics. I would add to that the fact that the security services themselves are playing a controversial role in the handling of the refugee issue for a number of structural, institutional, historical reasons that are too complicated to go into. Different factions of the security forces in Lebanon are politicized in different directions. And so far, the forces that have led the refugee management effort, if you will, have coordinated quite closely with Hezbollah and to a lesser extent with the Syrian regime. Sometimes this has taken the forms of sort of forced deportations of refugees, asylum seekers, dissidents from Syria, and indeed handing them back over to the regime or to Hezbollah. Not only is that a violation of international refugee law, but obviously that's created a sense of anxiety among Syrians that they aren't exactly 100% safe where they're going either, even in the security aspect, and that they're in an inhospitable environment. And they've come to expect in some instances the same treatment at the hands of some Lebanese that they've received elsewhere. There is a perception of Hezbollah being in control of Lebanon, which is slight exaggeration, but not by much, and an awareness that the non-Sunni population of the country is quite hostile to them, which isn't to imply that, you know, the Sunnis of Lebanon are universally ecstatic about the refugee situation. There is a general sort of sympathy for their plight and for indeed the entire opposition effort against the regime. But, you know, the Sunni population itself is very different across different parts of the country. You know, within Beirut and its surroundings, they're relatively prosperous, middle class. And, you know, although they complain about sort of traffic and beggars and, you know, illegal businesses popping up, I think the sheer impact of humanitarian suffering is sort of an abstraction to them. They're not really seeing it you know, in the way that the populations in Tripoli up north and the Bakar are seeing it, which makes it, on the one hand, more palatable to them. But on the other hand, there are complaints, and there has been decreasing sympathy. I can certainly feel that. Obviously, the environment in the north and the Bakar, these are, you know, miserably poor places. Even before this war started, the poorest areas of Lebanon, they contain almost half of the population that lives below the poverty line. And partly in truth and partly in perception, there's been an increase in unemployment as cheap labor floods these areas. Prices have gone up. Rents have gone up. There are sort of mostly anecdotal reports of crime and, you know, elements of fighting. And I'm not sure to what extent that's actually backed up by the data, but the point is that Lebanese, they think that that's the truth, and that is a sort of defining aspect of the refugee presence, which begs the question why the situation in Lebanon hasn't completely exploded yet. For me, at least, I think the short answer is it's not clear to me what exactly that would look like in the context of Lebanon, because unlike Turkey and Jordan and arguably Iraq, there isn't really a central government with strong institutions in Lebanon to break. The state is weak, decentralized. Most of the country has learned to sort of function imperfectly in the absence of institutions. So no matter what the impacts are, at least the direct ones, there isn't really, really, really radical change in life for most Lebanese. The political process, of course, preceded the refugees, certainly isn't caused by it, and certainly won't be solved with the refugee problem. The second, I think, mitigating factor against the complete collapse is some of these sort of social bonds that cross these borders, kinship, friendship. A lot of the areas along the northern border in particular, I mean, some of these places used to send their kids to be educated in Syria. People in Syria would send their kids to healthcare over the border into northern Lebanon. You know, the border isn't really delineated, obviously, nor is it very well controlled. But although that's changing a bit, but you know, these people are not strangers to one another for the most part. So there's a decent amount of goodwill among them. But I think the main reason this has sort of been kept in check so far is there hasn't been a significant militarization of the refugee population. Partly because the rebellion is consumed by fighting the regime in Syria. Partly because Hezbollah and the security forces have clamped down quite hard on rebel and weapons flows into Lebanon and from Lebanon. It's also because there's an international consensus, roughly, whereas they've agreed they're going to fight it out in Syria through their respective proxies, so far they've agreed that Lebanon should be mostly kept out of this element, at least, of the conflict. There isn't really a long-held tradition of militancy among most of the Sunnis in Lebanon. They're less organized, they have less of a martial tradition, they're less able to offer a base of support for the Syrian refugee population. And I think last but not least, there's still a sense among some Syrians that the situation is temporary. Now, it may well be, it may not, it may be very, very long term. I'm afraid it very much will be. But there are some spoilers that could pop up. Some of them have already been mentioned, but I would name Damascus and Tartus area north of Lebanon as the places to watch. If fighting expands significantly there, you will see a massive inflow of refugees back over the border into Lebanon. Also, you know, defeating the regime, were it to happen, and I don't know if that's in the foreseeable future, but if the regime collapses in Syria under the current state of what the opposition looks like, I believe, according to both my conversations with Syrians inside Lebanon and in Syria, that the vast majority would leave the country. Most of the ones we speak to now indicate that on the balance, they'd rather live in the regime-held areas. Certainly not because those are great places to live, but because of the situations in the opposition-held areas are so dire that they go where they can live and work. And finally, of course, there's the militarization aspect that would require a whole set of international and local dynamics that are not in place yet. But a militarized Sunni Syrian refugee population in Lebanon is a civil war in Lebanon, and an unavoidable one. And I think the longer the war goes on in Syria, the longer the refugees stay in Lebanon, I mean, inevitably this is going to happen unless one of those two things changes. And, you know, more directly and in the nearer future, I think there's a potentially serious civil unrest problem in the form of social and economic hardship in the camps. I think it's still too soon for that to have happened. But I think as the refugees begin to see that there isn't a solution on the horizon to the situation in Syria, then they're going to have to start thinking about what kind of lives they're going to lead where they are. At the moment, it looks like they're going to be quite bad ones. The international community has a role to play in all this. Certainly, it takes the form of direct budgetary support to the Lebanese government, as well as helping infrastructure and public services development, pressuring their respective parties of influence within Lebanon to form their government, elect the president, keep the parliament working. Those things have been difficult to do. Ruling out the forced relocation of refugees, that has to happen. And I believe that parties, including the United States, to have influence with the Lebanese government as well as over the armed forces, need to make sure that the refugees are treated within the basic rules of international law. The issue of asylum in the Western countries, I mean, frankly, I can only speculate as to why they haven't offered more of them. I believe part of it is there's a security concern, well-founded or otherwise, over the fact of many Syrian refugees coming into their countries, and partly because I think there's a general tendency reflexively to want to stay as far away from this issue as possible. And that includes, or perhaps applies especially to the United States. Finally, you know, frankly, the only solution is in Syria, and that will require not the regime winning or the other side winning, but somebody being able to create some sort of political order that is minimally just and offers some opportunity for economic development. You know, obviously the regime is not going to offer that, and the opposition as it exists now cannot offer it. The high commitment but unavoidable mission is to create some alternative like that in Syria, although unfortunately I don't perceive that there's the political will to do that. So I'll stop there.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks to all of you for a really compelling picture. I'm so sorry that we have indeed run out of time before getting into a discussion. If our speakers have a few minutes to hear comments or take questions, I am certainly willing to stay. I'm afraid our live stream comes to an end. Or perhaps we can keep that going for a few more minutes as well. Are you able to stay for a few more minutes? Okay, then let's just do 5 or 10 minutes for those of you who are able to stay. For those of you who are not, thank you very much for coming. Any questions, or are we all worn out at this point with absorbing so much information? Okay, let's start in the back there, and then we'll come right round this way. Let's take the comments or questions sort of all in a group, and then I'll give the speakers a chance to reply to those they'd like to.
Okay, thank you so much for taking the question, and thank you so much for all of your presentations. My quick question is, are there any concerns about statelessness? There was one reference to newborns in Turkey, and I'm wondering whether there's any concern about the creation of stateless persons who are born in these neighboring countries.
Okay, thank you. And this is Bernadette.
Sorry, my name is Bernadette Passad-Cisse, and I've worked with UNHCR, the Catholic Conference, and Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service.
Thank you. Gentleman here in the yellow shirt.
I'm Tom Loeb from Union College, and I was just wondering if you could comment about both in terms of Lebanon and Jordan about interaction between other refugee groups. We have the Iraqis that have gone to Jordan, and of course the Palestinians you mentioned going to everywhere. So are there hostile or cooperative relations between the various refugee flows?
Thank you. Very good question. Yes. Go ahead, please, briefly.
And my question is about the Syrian doctors who became refugees in Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey. And in spite of all our effort to make sure that they practice medicine and get some type of licensure, how come that so far it has not been done, except I think in some areas in Turkey, in the refugee camps, there should be allowed to at least treat Syrian refugees, which there are plenty of them, and they can do it for free. But they need a license.
Okay.
Thank you very much. My name is Oscar Castellanos from Americans for UNESCO. I see with great concern this surge on anti-refugee attitudes in some of the local communities in the host countries. And my quick question is, what have you seen, or what are the responses that you have evaluated like the best from the international community? I mean, what were the responses that you see are being the most effective to tackle or to cope with this this problem?
Thank you. And was there one more behind? No, that's it. Oh, yes, there is one more. I'm sorry.
Natasha Hall with DHS Resettlement. My question is actually a follow-up to yours, but specifically with regards to the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, and specifically with regards to militarization in the camps. If you could speak to that, especially Ain El Hilweh, there's been some dramatic developments.
Okay, thank you all for your questions, and thank you for your brevity as well. Let's give our speakers a chance for last words in response to these questions, or any other last words you might want. Shall we just go down the...
Okay, regarding the statelessness, in each of the neighboring countries, I think there are more than 10,000 new Syrians were born in the neighboring countries. So there are a lot of Syrians who are born in neighboring countries. Actually, this statelessness issue is a huge debate in Turkey. Actually, there is a huge criticism from the opposition parties that the Syrians will be accepted as Turkish citizens or not. So whether they will vote in the elections or not. So this statelessness issue is a problem, but I think this problem will not be solved in the near future, and also this statelessness issue cannot be solved in the near future. So this is the situation actually in Turkey. But this is a problem. There are a lot of Syrians who were born in the neighboring countries, and they do not have any citizenship in the neighboring countries. So actually, this is a problem which we should take into consideration.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's good to see that statelessness is getting more attention generally in the international community. But this is really, I hope that the thinking about it can keep up with those challenges which are multiplying. Tarikhan?
Yeah, maybe I'll just speak to the statelessness. Many of those I said are Kurdish. From Kurdish origin, from Syria, and they already, many of them, Kurds in Syria, had no citizenship. They were taken away by the regime, basically. So, like in Turkey, there's a discussion what happens. They're Kurdish origin, so they're treated as a brother. But right now, I think they just, it's in discussion. But so we already have
statelessness. And I think you touched a bit on the interaction with other refugee groups in Kurdistan.
It is also like there's one thing with the hostilities towards the refugees. Like the red line in the Kurdistan region, or like the people are very welcoming, but when it comes to security, the endangering of security and stability, that's the red line. And with the refugee influx, we had one day in August, they were like, in 6 days, 30,000 entered the Peshkabu border. And of course, you don't go and ask everybody, who are you, where you're from, or let me check your bags. It's impossible. Terrorist cells have used these opportunities to enter these different countries. And this is when, and then something also happened in Erbil in November, an attack by ISIS, claimed by ISIS in the capital. And that's when people get like, okay, maybe we should not accept them, or maybe it's time to send them back. But it's really the issue of security. And my last comment is just on this question is bigger, like especially with the Kurdistan region, you have many questions. What it's all going to depend, there's the Kurdish question, there's the Kurdish question in Syria, there's the question of what's going to happen with Syria, what's going to happen with Iran, what's going to happen. This will all affect policies of international policies, geopolitics. So it's just like this issue is just so interconnected and has many aspects. And yeah.
Thank you very much. Let's go to Faisal. And Dr. Kardash the last word.
The Palestinian-Syrian issue, I could see why that question would arise. The Palestinian population, the refugee population in Lebanon, is segregated into a very different type of camp than the camps that we're talking about in the countries that are accommodating Syrian refugees. These are essentially very densely populated urban environments that are literally encircled by Lebanese security forces. And therefore, the Palestinian population doesn't have any meaningful interaction, at least on the group, the Syrian-Palestinian level, with the Syrian refugees. They're in different areas, and they're living in very different contexts. That could be an issue in the future, but they don't necessarily share grievances or even particularly fond of one another. So I don't know what that would look like, but it does bring up the question of militarization, which is what you posed. What's going on in Ain al-Halwa, which is a camp in Sidon, is that there are militant groups pre-existing there that are trying to link up with militant groups that have been born of the conflict in Syria, and sort of fight together against Hezbollah, some of the Lebanese security forces that they perceive as collaborating with Hezbollah and the Syrian regime, as well as operate from Lebanon into Syria. This could happen, it probably is at some level, but the security forces, and particularly Hezbollah, are hypersensitive to this. To the extent that they see any of these threats emerging, they will preempt them and move against them. And last year in Sidon, in the suburb of Sidon, this is exactly what happened, whereby you had this sort of joint operation involving Hezbollah and part of the Lebanese armed forces against a Sunni militant Islamist group that has sort of set up shop and was trying to expand into Ain al-Halwa. At present, they appear to have the capacity to be able to overwhelm these groups and interrupt them. Whether they'll continue to have that capacity, particularly as Hezbollah is consumed by the Syria issue, I don't know. That certainly raises an important question, yeah.
And finally,
Dr. Kardash. About the Jordanian context, I could add a little bit into the debate. So as we see it, there are a couple of camps, but most of the Syrians are also living outside camps. And then so far, we haven't experienced any major, in our field work, tension between different refugees in Jordan. As you hinted, there are Iraqis who fled after the American invasion. There are, of course, Palestinians there. But in Jordan, we see such a process, sort of a bailing out system from the camps. So as was suggested in the case of Lebanon, many people who did come to Jordan, they have relatives or friends or other connections, tribal or other connections. In one way or another, after staying for a while in the camps, those friends come to the camp management and they bail them out. So in that sense, there is some circulation going on. The population in the camps is not growing. So especially in the northern parts, you see the towns where right now in some occasions, in Raqqa, I guess, the population is now more than 50% Syrian. But between, this is creating some tension, but between different refugee groups, we haven't experienced something like that. But the question about the statelessness, it raises a very important legal problem. I guess the broader question is the integration question. The current projections about the crisis, whether it may end anytime soon, even if it ends tomorrow politically, the situation on the ground, the economic conditions, the social conditions in Syria, given the level of destruction so far, will make it hard for the people to return back anytime soon. So then it forces the host countries to consider ways to facilitate their integration, but especially in certain situations like such as Lebanon and Jordan, the resources that are already in poor supply, such as water in the case of Jordan, are under really heavy pressure. Mm-hmm. But also the schooling, the health system, we see that suddenly there is another 10%, 15% load on the existing schooling system, existing health system. It creates tension. So the statelessness is one problem, but especially the social impact is, I guess, is a an even more urgent problem. Here the question about doctors among the refugees, their ability to work. I don't know exactly the current situation, but right now the Turkish side has been the most strict in terms of not letting Syrian refugees, those who are staying in the camps, to work outside. But now we see that with this prospect of staying longer, there are considerations about sort of facilitating, easing their work. The director of AFAD also mentioned the schools inside the camps. I know that they are hiring, for instance, Syrian teachers to teach in these schools. As regards doctors, I don't know the exact problem here, but the Turkish licensing system is very strict. I know from my own friends that even those Turkish doctors who did study in European countries, when they return back home, they have to go through a very strict process. This might have to do with that as well. And also the similar problem, for instance, about students who want to study at Turkish universities. Like in this crisis situation, conflict situation, sometimes it's difficult to gather the proper documents and to make a legitimate case that they were indeed third year student at that particular department in this particular university. But especially with the prospect of staying longer, now the host communities, including Turkey, do realize that they have to find ways to integrate. And last time I was chatting with the director of AFAD, he also indicated that he mentioned the database. With this database, they also sort of gathering information about the skills of the Syrians so that they can be accommodated in different jobs based on their own credentials, professional credentials. But the doctors, given the licensing, they might face some additional challenges. This might be the reason.
As they do here in many other countries of first asylum and of settlement. I cannot thank you all enough for your comments, for your work on this issue, and to you for your good questions and your participation and for your perseverance in staying with us. Please join me in thanking our speakers and thanking Orsan.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.